Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Monday, May 3rd. Thanks for joining us. I'm Clay Collins.
And I'm Kendra Nordine Beato.
The National Football League's draft is both a commodification of talent and a career gateway. Follow the safety protocols, guard those finances, and a player might carry family and friends into better lives. This year's draft wrapped up over the weekend and delivered, as always, some warm backstories about athletes already honoring the places from which they came. Najee Harris, a standout running back at the University of Alabama, dropped in on a watch party at a homeless shelter in Richmond, California, before the first round, in which he'd go to the Pittsburgh Steelers, got underway. He brought food and gratitude. He and his parents and four siblings had lived at the shelter for a few years when he was growing up. "There was a time I needed a helping hand," he told Sports Illustrated. "They gave us an opportunity to get back on our feet, so it is my job to give back." Kwity Paye, a defensive end from the University of Michigan, was born in a refugee camp in Guinea to a Liberian mother who'd witnessed atrocities and escaped a refugee camp in Sierra Leone on foot, eventually making it to Rhode Island, where she worked double shifts in nursing homes. Mr. Paye got to play at a Catholic high school, approaching the game with a monk-like gravity, as an ESPN profile put it. A first-round pick of the Indianapolis Colts, Mr. Paye has a goal beyond NFL success, to make it easier for other people who want to become U.S. citizens. "Being able to become someone of status and then go back to my community and uplift them," he told ESPN, "that's something I look forward to." Now, today's stories. Our first story. Tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court takes up a case that for many epitomizes the racial injustice bound up in sentencing rules left over from the war on drugs. Will its decision herald reform?
Tara Rick Terry's case is, broadly, a story about regret and redemption. But it's also a story about how the specific wording in a law can quickly breed confusion in the courts. The sentencing rule that treated crack cocaine 100 times worse than powder had been in effect for 20 years by the time Mr. Terry was sentenced in 2008. The disparity has come to be viewed by critics spanning the political spectrum as one of the great injustices of the war on drugs. It's been one of the key drivers of mass incarceration, those critics say, in particular, subjecting thousands of low-level offenders, the vast majority young people of color, to long prison terms. In the past decade, Congress has reduced almost all of those sentences, all except for Mr. Terry and the thousands of low-level crack offenders like him. It's a deferred justice that has brought him into an unlikely alliance with congressional leaders from both parties, as well as former federal judges, prosecutors, and latterly, the Biden administration. On Tuesday, it will bring him to the U.S. Supreme Court, when the justices will hear arguments on whether this vestige of another era should be eliminated. This story was reported by Henry Gass in Irving, Texas, for The Monitor.
A commitment to improving public works could make Moscow, a legendarily snarled city, easier to get around in and greener, too. We look at the complex roots of a priority shift.
Getting from place to place in Moscow often requires an exhausting and demoralizing effort. Lately, the city's urban planners have put on their green caps. Their latest project is to construct a green ring of bicycle paths and hiking trails to connect the city's giant parks, and also a network of bicycle lanes and parking areas throughout the city that will enable Muscovites to go to work, do their shopping, or just get around by electric scooter or bicycle, much as people already do in modern European cities. What makes this remarkable is that, unlike Western green programs, these initiatives are coming from the top, spawned by a largely unaccountable bureaucracy that faces little pressure from civil society or elected legislators. This form of urban government might be described as authoritarian technocracy, a Moscow-sized version of the system created by Vladimir Putin. The city's leadership is making Moscow into the showcase of a modern authoritarian state, says Nikolay Petrov, a senior researcher at Chatham House in London. They're sure they know what they are doing, and they don't need to listen to ordinary inhabitants. It's not a praiseworthy model. This story was reported by Fred Weir in Moscow for The Monitor.
The pandemic has put many tourism hotspots in peril. We found one that's thriving, but one where locals also have a message for visitors. More important than your money is your respect.
Residents on Taiwan's Orchid Island are used to solitude. The island lies a jet prop flight or wavy ferry ride away from Taiwan's main island, and residents are mostly Tao, an indigenous Austronesian group that was here thousands of years before the Chinese arrived. But Orchid's azure and emerald shores draw snorkelers, and the community has seen a dramatic surge in domestic tourism during the pandemic. Suddenly, the remote island was the closest thing Taiwanese tourists could get to an overseas vacation. Today, visitors rent motor scooters to cruise along the bumpy island road, stopping for snaps at rocky overlooks and beaches lined with boats for catching flying fish. At a time when global tourism stands to lose $1.2 trillion, many residents are excited about the influx. But it has prompted tough questions for the Tao about how their culture and environment can coexist with so many visitors. Tourists often treat locals like an exotic curiosity, shooting photos of them in their homes from the street without asking first or offering to pay. Tourists must do their homework before coming over, says resident Sai Ingalapkap. I want to make money, but I want to protect my culture. This story was reported by Ralph Jennings in Yayo Village, Taiwan, for The Monitor.
Nourishment takes different forms. Planting a community oasis in a food desert is about much more than nutrition. It's also about opportunity and healing.
Almost 10 years ago, Cheryl Gaines, a pastor, started the Project Eden Community Garden as a response to the South Capitol Street Massacre, one of Washington's worst mass shootings in decades. Her idea then, as now, was that no community chooses violence when it has another option. Since then, Reverend Gaines and her son and hundreds of local employees and volunteers have offered such an option. Project Eden sources its produce in the form of seeds through donations, grants, and community partnerships. While the selection depends on what's available, volunteers follow a loose crop rotation of roots, legumes, fruits, and greens, like the lush Swiss chard growing tall this season. They also distribute the food along with donations from a food bank to the community. On a mid-April Saturday, the day of weeding, watering, and other scattered work began with an a cappella rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem. Volunteers, who regularly call each other brother and sister, stood in a circle and sang together. Project Eden isn't just resisting material challenges of nutrition and income, says Caroline Brewer of the Audubon Naturalist Society. It's helping the community resist despair. It's a constant battle, she says, and they're winning that battle. This story was reported by Noah Robertson in Washington for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on India's success in fighting hunger. India is now home to 1 in 3 new coronavirus cases, yet despite the grim number, it has done something quite well over the past year. It has managed to feed most of its people, a result of more than a half century of reforms aimed at ending the country's history of famines. A new report from the International Food Policy Research Institute gives one reason food kept flowing during the crisis. The report states, India's rapid policy actions and effective coordination across national, state, and local institutions helped buffer the initial shocks to health and nutrition programs. This success reflects India's decades of investments in social safety net infrastructure. Such lessons will be needed in 2021. The United Nations estimates the number of people vulnerable to severe hunger will nearly double because of the pandemic. As a result, the UN plans to hold the Food Systems Summit 2021 in September to transform how the world produces and consumes food. By then, India hopes to be on top of the pandemic. As it is, it can offer lessons on how it constantly innovates in agriculture and in other aspects of the food supply. In times of crisis, those lessons pay off. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for kicking off another week with us. Tomorrow, we'll be back in the U.S. Capitol and back on the subject of food aid with an audio story to give your eyes a screen break about an organization that pivoted to serving first-time recipients with special attention to preserving their dignity. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how God helped her in her struggles with addiction. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Nick Roll.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.